Support for the morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information at carthage.edu/grad. Support also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. On today's morning show, we are looking back at an iconic American film, Breakfast at Tiffany's, and at the transcendently beautiful and charming actress who starred in it, Audrey Hepburn. We look back with author Sam Wasson, whose book is called Fifth Avenue, 5 a.m., Audrey Hepburn, Breakfast at Tiffany's, and the Dawn of the Modern Woman. Sam Wasson's previous book is about the film's director, Blake Edwards, and I began the interview by asking Sam Wasson about the connection between that earlier book and this one.
When I started writing this book about Blake Edwards, I really wasn't a huge Tiffany's fan. What got me into Blake's work was the Pink Panther and the Dudley Moore film 10 and Shot in the Dark and all of that slapstick stuff that Blake mastered over the course of his career. So Tiffany's was really just a curiosity, I should say a kind of a fabulous curiosity in his career. And when it came time to write this chapter in the book about Blake, I thought it would be, you know, a walk in the park. I figured there'd be so much information out there on this, the most romantic comedy ever made, that I really wouldn't have to lift a finger. But I found that I was really, really wrong. There was nothing out there on this film aside from some gooey fan writing, the kind of stuff I don't really like, just adoring and without real historical perspective. And I thought, well, if no one's told this story, it's got to be told. And the more I dug, the more fascinated I got, not just with Audrey herself and her own personal life and what was going on with her and her husband Mel Ferrer at the time of shooting, but with obviously Blake Edwards and the screenwriter George Axelrod and Edith Head and her conflicts with Hubert de Givenchy, Audrey's designer, and Truman Capote's own dramas. I thought, well, there's a story here that's as thrilling as the one that we see on screen. In fact, I think even more thrilling.
I mean, probably ultimately richer with more layers. I mean, just endlessly interesting on all kinds of different levels. And I think you're so wise to go beyond the film and also tell us quite a lot about the book and about Truman Capote. At one point, you talk about Truman Capote being equal parts yearning and vengeance. What an interesting thing to say about him.
That's great. I forgot about that. yes, that's terrific. That's exactly right. You know, here's a guy who never really found a happy home. His father was absent from the picture early on, and his mother, very much like Holly Golightly, was trying to get herself a foothold in the high life. And she came from a poor Alabama background, no money, no glamour, and she spent a lot of time away from Truman trying to find the sugar daddy to get her up to the penthouse. So Truman was, you know, had a lot of space to yearn for home, for mother, for belonging. And when he didn't get it, my God, you know, he became angry. He was a killer, a bulldog, Capote. And we see those qualities in Holly Golightly, on the page in Capote's novel, more so than the movie. The movie really smooths out Holly Golightly, makes her more flowery and sweet. But on the page, she's a tough cookie, just like Truman.
Mm. You also tell us that there are quite a few women at the time who said that they were the inspiration for that character. And probably in some cases, some of these women sincerely believe that, For all we know, maybe Truman Capote told them so. But
I bet he did. In fact, you know, he was such a he was so seductive. Not only as a writer, and in his own research was he seductive, trying to get sources to talk, but you know, he wanted to get close to the rich and the famous. So telling these young women he was writing a book about them, which in fact he was, that wasn't just, you know, a lot of hot air, really served him both emotionally and creatively. But what ended up happening, of course, is that everyone said, well, I'm Holly Golightly. Everybody thought they were Holly Golightly, some who really had no claim to Holly at all. But that just goes to show you how close he was to this bullseye in the culture, that everyone saw themselves in this girl. He really nailed it.
Hmm. We should explain to our listeners that your book really unfolds chronologically, that as the book opens, Truman Capote is about to write the book, Breakfast at Tiffany, and sort of at the same time, we are learning about the very early professional career of Audrey Hepburn and the real surprises, the coincidences, the luck, which she very freely acknowledged were so much a part of the opportunities that came her way. And so even as this book is taking shape, so are the earliest professional successes of this intriguing woman named Audrey Hepburn. And we sort of read of those developments essentially side by side. I love the way you put that together.
Thank you. You know, thank you for recognizing that. To make a movie is such a collaborative enterprise. And in the arts, perhaps the most collaborative enterprise. It takes hundreds upon hundreds of people to make a movie. And when you have artists whose lives are being put into that film, to really understand how that film came about, you got to trace their whole life to a certain extent, to see what was really on the line here. What were they after? What piece of their own soul and history got onto that screen, and why? And to do that, I had to follow Audrey. I had to follow George Axelrod, the screenwriter, who had a tremendous amount of emotional investment in this picture, the producers, the director, the costume designers, Capote himself, and, of course, you know, Audrey Hepburn, who never really wanted to do the movie in the first place.
Well, and who had real hesitation about becoming an actress at all. I mean, one of the best stories you share is of that very much chance encounter back in the early 50s in Paris when the great French writer Colette sees Audrey Hepburn and realizes this is the woman who can bring her character of Gigi to life on the stage. Although Audrey Hepburn herself is the last person to believe that she's capable of that.
And Audrey Hepburn, her whole life, never thought she was an actress. And we can understand, by way of that Colette story, how Audrey's modesty was far more than just simple humility. She really, you know, got this going by chance. She wanted to be a dancer. The fact that she would ever have to say lines on screen scared her and really always did through her whole life. So when Colette came up to her and said, "You're the girl," Audrey's first instinct was, "No, I'm not the girl." So if you flash forward 10 years later, or more than 10 years rather, to Breakfast at Tiffany's, where that very girl is being asked to play a call girl, farther from her own natural instincts than any role she'd ever played, well, you could see how Audrey would just be terrified, more than just having been thrust into a world that was challenging her own image and her own good girl persona. She was now being asked really to play someone else, to act. So I think telling that story about Colette really hopefully gives the reader a real sense of where Audrey's coming from emotionally. It was so important for me to include that.
In addition to all that you write about, I mean, you kind of rattled off that long list of all of the different elements that are necessary for a major motion picture to come together, and we trace all of these various lines. But if all that weren't enough, you also talk about women in general in the early 1950s and some of what they, generally speaking, were going through. At one point, you write, with an unprecedented degree of leisure time and more media access than ever before, the 50s woman was the single most vulnerable woman in American history to the grasp of prefab wholesale thought, and by extension, to the men who made it. The message of conformity poured in through every opening from the outside, making it impossible for her to shut it out without shutting out the world. And of course, what you're suggesting is that if on the surface so much of the 1950s was about Doris Day and Debbie Reynolds, that in fact, just beneath the surface, something else much more complex is going on, which in a sense sets the stage for the film we're talking about today.
Yes, that's perfectly said. That's perfectly said. There was another world, a darker world, going on that the movies were not showing. They were showing, as you say, Doris Day and Debbie Reynolds. And when it came through in the form of Elizabeth Taylor, she had to pay the price, generally, or reform somehow. Pleasure did not come without a little bit of pain in Hollywood in the 1950s. So by the time you have a call girl in the form of Audrey Hepburn getting away with it, you're really dealing with a new phenomenon in Hollywood.
You talk about Audrey Hepburn. This is even before Breakfast at Tiffany. I think this may be as you're talking about what I think is basically her first major film, Roman Holiday.
Yeah.
You write, in this era of stark conservatism, Audrey managed to make different okay. Better than okay, she made it good. That is, being different and fresh.
Right.
Somehow with her, it was nothing to fear in the way that it might be from a different sort of person.
Right, right. Like for instance, a James Dean. He didn't quite make being a rebel without a cause kosher. That was still dangerous in his film. And obviously, he paid the price for being a rebel in the end. But if you look at Audrey, her rebellion is very, very clean, subversive, and socially and culturally acceptable because she's not asking for a revolution. She's being a good girl as she's testing the boundaries. So it becomes a part of the culture as it's resisting the culture. It's like a little underground revolution that because of its subversive quality, because of its covert maneuverings, can really get into the water without anybody knowing better.
We're speaking with Sam Wasson. We're talking about his book, Fifth Avenue, 5 a.m., which recounts the story of Breakfast at Tiffany's, the creation of the book, its transformation into a screenplay, and the making of this remarkable film starring the remarkable Audrey Hepburn. Talk a moment, if you would, about the challenge of adapting Truman Capote's original work for the screen. What an interesting, tough challenge that was, a challenge which the first proposed screenwriter failed miserably at, Sumner Locke Elliott.
You got it. Well, you know, Capote's novel is not a romantic comedy. It's a very dark, conflicted character study about a very unhappy and lonely woman, Holly Golightly, and it's narrated by a gay man. It's, of course, his sexuality is coded in the novel. It's not necessarily explicit, but it's there. So how do you turn this not love story about a not heterosexual relationship into a American, wholesome, I use American in quotes, Hollywood mainstream comedy? You really have to change in a profound way your material. And that's not easy to do without dismantling the entire intent of the piece to begin with. So it's really a house of cards. How do you rearrange this movie so that it ends up being something completely different without losing what it was originally? And I go into this in great detail in the book and how the eventual writer, George Axelrod, had to devise a whole new story and set of characters for the film. And in fact, I really think of Breakfast at Tiffany's, the screenplay, as a unique and self-sustaining work of art apart from Capote's novel. I think the changes are that profound.
I also find really, really intriguing the means by which Mr. Axelrod tried to, in a sense, throw off Jeffrey Sherlock, whom you call Hollywood's new moral watchdog. He would have been the person who would have, blanked out with a red editing pen anything thought to be morally past a certain line. But you also talk about how this is, because this is kind of a turbulent moment in Hollywood history, Hollywood's trying to sort things out for itself. This was a moment when if someone was imaginative and a little careful, some really groundbreaking work could be done.
Well, yes, and I'm glad you mentioned Jeffrey Sherlock. A lot of people don't know or don't remember that there was such a thing as late as 1960, a production code in Hollywood, a censorship board that had, as you say, a red pen to every script to make sure that things didn't get too hot. So it was up to the filmmakers, if they really wanted to say something bold, to play coy with the censors, to find a way to get around them. They couldn't be too overt, otherwise they'd be found out. And on the other hand, they couldn't be too subtle that nobody got what they were onto. So that really is a tribute to George Axelrod and Blake Edwards, that they managed to get Breakfast at Tiffany's as subtle and sophisticated, full of innuendo, as they did. And you could see how Audrey Hepburn really helped their case because of the subtlety of her revolution, because she wasn't like James Dean, guns a-blazing, waving red flags in the air. She could take all of that innuendo and put a pretty bow on it so that when Jeffrey Sherlock sits down to look at the movie, he's not scared away.
Particularly by her character.
Right, particularly by her character, who people don't realize or are afraid to admit is a call girl.
Right, and of course, your book points out, among other things, that this would have been an entirely different film and maybe not even made at all if, for instance, Marilyn Monroe had been cast in that role.
Right, and of course, Marilyn was the first person they went to. She was Truman's first choice for Holly-Golightly. And, you know, it sounds strange to us because Audrey is now iconic in that role and we are so accustomed to her, and she is indeed the right choice. But you can see in Marilyn a certain roughness that Capote was attracted to. But to get back to your point, if Marilyn were responsible for all of this innuendo, it wouldn't have been innuendo. It would have been right there out for everybody to see and for Jeffrey Sherlock to strike from the screen.
We've mentioned the name of Blake Edwards, who ultimately is the director, but he was not on the short list of directors with whom Audrey Hepburn was willing to work on this film. I mean, she accepts this role with great reluctance. We've already kind of touched on why. And you talk about how at this point, with each success, it was almost as though making films, being an actress, was becoming actually harder and harder, not easier and easier for Audrey Hepburn. And she needed the strong hand of a director that she truly trusted. So this was not just the willful insistence of a self-centered actress.
No.
But this was an artist really anxious to do her best work.
That's right.
And so that's part of what's going on here when she insists on certain directors, none of whom are available or interested.
Right. That's exactly right. This is more than ego, the actor's ego. Audrey needed someone to hold her hand. She was scared. And that performance could not have happened without Blake Edwards standing by the camera every day, talking Audrey through her uncomfortable passages, working with her every night, sometimes clashing heads with Mel Ferrer, her husband, who was directing Audrey behind the scenes. He should not have been. So Blake was there every step of the way, absolutely. And as you say, was really not one of the first choices. Audrey wanted somebody that she knew she was comfortable with, a director she had worked with before. And Blake Edwards was at that point not only new to Audrey, but fairly new to mainstream big budget A pictures. He had had a success with Cary Grant in Operation Petticoat, a huge success. But at that point, he was still new to the screen, not proven in the same way that a Willie Wyler was, or a Billy Wilder was, or a Fred Zinnemann was. He was the new kid on the block.
Hmm. I think it's so interesting that as you describe Blake Edwards at this moment in his career, when this assignment crosses his path, he's finishing up a film that he just hates called High Time with Bing Crosby, which you write was proof positive that the industry was panicked about the new generation. Who were these kids? They had sex, they did drugs, and like everyone else, they went to the movies. But what did they want to see? In 1960, no one in Hollywood had a clue. The year's top films were Swiss Family Robinson and Psycho. And so,
isn't that great?
Yeah. So here's Blake Edwards in the midst of making this, what he regards as a completely moronic film called High Time. And in a sense, that helps make him, in a sense, hungry for this new opportunity to direct an adaption of Breakfast at Tiffany's. I mean, it could be an entirely different kind of film, much more important.
You got it. That's exactly right. You know, this is now, the 50s are now coming to a close, but the 60s haven't quite begun. The sexual revolution is still years off. The pill and the Beatles and JFK still a few years away. So it really is a kind of awkward threshold between eras. And a film like High Time, which is a college comedy, but starring Bing Crosby, goes to show you the real schizophrenic personality complex that Hollywood was going through. How do we deal with this new young generation? What is it? And Tiffany's takes it head on. You know, Holly looks sophisticated, and indeed she is sophisticated, but she's a girl. She really is a young girl. We forget that because Audrey makes it seem okay. It makes her seem adult, but really we're talking about a teenage girl here. Young women might have had a better sense of that. People who knew the novel might have had a better sense of that, but Jeffrey Sherlock sure didn't.
We're speaking with Sam Wasson about his book, Fifth Avenue, 5 a.m. Of course, in the 21st century, Breakfast at Tiffany's might seem like pretty tame stuff, but it's probably important. I hope we've done enough to say just what sort of a hot, potentially deeply controversial work this, in fact, was. First when it was published, and then at that moment where it was going to become a film. One thing I don't think we've said is that when it came to publish at least excerpts from it in a magazine, there were several leading candidates, of that is magazines, that sort of turned away from this possibility. That helps us understand just what kind of a work we're talking about.
Yes, I think it was Harper's. It's not so fresh in my mind, but I think it was Harper's that originally turned down Capote's manuscript.
I think that's right.
And Capote had a relationship with Harper's, and he was a literary celebrity at this point. So they're really making a formidable decline here. And that really says something about what was going on in this manuscript. At one point, they cited the use of certain four-letter words. I'm not certain what that four-letter word was. It's not the F word. I know that, having spoken to Capote's biographer. But we think it might have been, I don't know how much I can say on the air, but a four-letter word beginning with a D.
Okay.
That's a pejorative term for a lesbian. In fact, that was how Holly referred to herself in part as a half D word. And there you have something else that was excised from the film. There is no suggestion that Holly has had a bisexual past.
Hmm.
But in Capote's novel, you know, she was quite open about it.
Right. You've already talked about how some of the changes that were made were Mr. Axelrod in adapting this book for the screen. There are other changes that actually Audrey Hepburn insisted on before she would play this character. And again, as we read your book, we realize more and more that she came very close to turning it down. And it's just so intriguing to think about how this movie would have been different, how her life would have been different if she hadn't summoned the courage and maybe given in to the curiosity to take on this project.
Yeah, you know, I think Audrey Hepburn would, I think her career would have potentially suffered. We were moving from the 50s into the 60s, and she had to get with it, or else she would have stayed a young girl of the early 50s. This brought her into the new generation, and it wasn't until Two for the Road several years later that she really became a full woman of the late 60s. But that's another story altogether.
I am really appreciative of the fact that although Audrey Hepburn in so many ways is the heart and soul of this film, she is by no means the entirety of the cast.
No, she is
joined by some really, really fine performers, including one of my all-time favorite actresses, Patricia Neal.
Yes.
And she is opposite romantically Mr. George Peppard. And it's really interesting to read about the rather stormy relationships that there were between George Peppard and his co-stars and director, for that matter.
Yeah, well, you know, it's not something that I was happy to report, but I wanted to be faithful to what everybody was telling me, and that was George Peppard was a difficult guy. He was not happy sharing the screen with Audrey. He wanted the film to belong to him. And he had a working style that was closer to the way a method actor works, and that really wasn't conducive to the more classical style of Audrey Hepburn or Blake Edwards. So there was a significant amount of alienation going on between Peppard and the cast. A lot of it, based on two different philosophies, but a lot of it was also a question of personality. You know, at one point, Peppard almost hit Blake in the face. He was so angry with what was going on off camera. So it's a serious personality problem,
I would say. You also outline for us a really intriguing controversy that surrounded the choice of casting Mickey Rooney in a relatively minor yet significant role, particularly significant in terms of how some people were really unhappy by that choice and by his presence in this film.
Well, you know, a lot of people say, well, it was that time, you know, it was a different time. And in fact, it wasn't simply that time. Richard Shepard, one of the film's producers, told me that he was so offended shooting the film, he insisted Blake take out the scene. Now, obviously, Shepard, for one reason or another, didn't prevail. I don't know why. He was a busy man, had a lot on his plate, and Blake probably insisted. So it was an embarrassment even then to the filmmakers. And I will say, to Mr. Edwards' credit, he did apologize before his death. He said it was a miscalculation on his part. It was meant in just good fun. But obviously we could see that it's a horribly racist misstep. Mm.
I think at this point we have danced around all kinds of different aspects of this story and ultimately of this film. For the sake of someone who has actually not seen Breakfast at Tiffany, could you sketch out the basic outlines of the story? And I think not so much as Truman Capote originally wrote it, but as we see it in the film. Essentially, what is this story about?
Well, thematically, it's about the conflict between being alone and free and being in love and tied down. And in a more complex reading, are you really tied down when you're not free? In other words, when you're married and in love, can you still have freedom? And that's a universal theme for everyone falling in love, and certainly for a young woman coming of age. And Audrey Hepburn really represents that drama of, should I grow up or should I stay young? Am I a mature woman? Am I a young girl? And Tiffany's is really that story of how she makes that decision.
One of the elements of Breakfast at Tiffany's that is absolutely irreplaceable and yet in some ways almost didn't happen is the really magical score of Henry Mancini.
Yeah.
And, of course, the great song that is also so very, very famous, Moon River.
Right.
I wonder if you could just say a word about who Henry Mancini was at this moment in time and how fortunate we are that he ultimately was chosen and that his score as he wrote it ultimately was heard.
Well, you know, I'm glad you mentioned that because Mancini was not a major name at this point, nor was Blake Edwards. They were both in the early phases of their career, had a few successes, but they hadn't had the Pink Panther yet, that's for sure. The studio didn't really want Mancini on the film. They wanted more of a sort of a smooth jazz sound, sort of like a Broadway sound, less of a cool jazz sound. I know it sounds like a subtle distinction, but Mancini was a real jazz musician, and Blake had to insist to get him in the picture. And once he did, well, from there, they wrote Moon River. And by they, I mean Mancini and Johnny Mercer. And it's gone on to become one of the most popular American songs ever written. But, of course, it's interesting to remember, or at least mention, that the studio wanted to cut Moon River from the movie. I was just blown away when I found that out.
I was astounded, too, and as I read that, I didn't remember who this particular person was, but it must have been a studio head of one kind or another who is really quite emphatic that, I mean, all of this is just great, but this song has to go.
And, yeah.
And it's so intriguing because, I mean, every person involved in the film who had anything to say was equally adamant that song wasn't going anywhere, but it's just astonishing to think about how someone could view that film and hear that song and not understand what everybody else understood.
Well, it goes to show you what a miracle a movie is when it works, because there are so many opportunities for great work to go unnoticed, to hit the cutting room floor, and here we have Moon River on its way down. So that any movie comes out wonderful is the product of so many great talents and fortuitous coincidences. Even something like Breakfast at Tiffany's, you know, almost didn't make it on many counts, and not just Moon River. You know, it was nearly not Audrey's movie. It was nearly not even made. So the story of Breakfast at Tiffany's is really the story of a whole host of different miracles.
Right, and I was going to say a story of near misses. That's not it. It's the near disasters or doors almost closing that would have changed everything. I happen to be a music professor in my other life when I'm not here at the radio station, and so I was especially interested to read your account of Henry Mancini laboring lovingly and yet almost kind of grimly over the task of trying to write a song that Audrey Hepburn would be able to sing and sing well. And, of course, one of the most daunting challenges any composer faces is to write something that is simple and interesting.
Well, you know, I think that was Mancini's genius. He could get in a melody quicker. I don't just mean quicker in work time, but I mean quicker in music time, quicker than anyone else. His tunes are short, sweet, to the point, and unforgettable. Not the sweeping orchestral sound we like to think of of the studio films, but this guy was really working with small, bite-sized, catchy phrases. And I can't think of anyone else in the history of American film scoring who had that kind of genius. Maybe John Williams. Mancini's a level above.
Another element of this film involves the costumes. And you spend plenty of time telling us about a formidable woman by the name of Edith Head, nominated many, 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 many times over for Academy Awards for her work. But she was somewhat shunted aside in this film. I mean, she had work on it to do, I think was given the credit of costume supervisor or something.
Right.
But I mean, she had to make way for somebody else for the splashiest costumes that we see in this film.
Yes, Edith Head was the head of the costume department at Paramount. She was respected, feared, and quite talented in her own right. But Audrey had it in her contract that her gowns were to be designed by Hubert de Givenchy, her old friend and longtime designer. Well, obviously that doesn't sit well with Edith Head, but there was nothing Edith could do because Audrey was Audrey. She could call the shots. She was the big star. And it's good that she did, because while Edith has given us some of the most memorable costumes in film history, just think of most any Hitchcock movie, and Edith Head's probably behind it. She wasn't hip to the 1960s. She was very much a 50s designer, conservative, master of the shirtwaist dress. But in comes Givenchy, who really does have a look of elegance, a look of sophistication that women of the 50s really didn't. They were pretty. They were dressed in, you know, flamboyantly colored skirts and tight-fitting shirts. You wouldn't think of these women as mostly elegant, girls of the 50s, I mean.
Hmm.
Women are always elegant in any era, but the girls of the 50s were just cute. In comes Givenchy and takes cute to glamorous. And now that says a lot about a girl's private life. When you see her in a glamorous dress, it suggests a certain sophistication, a certain sexuality. And that went a long way towards painting Holly-Golightly as the sort of woman she is. That dress tells you just what this character is doing every night.
Hmm. And you quote another designer by the name of Jeffrey Banks as saying, Givenchy and Audrey gave us a very realistic, very accessible kind of class. All of a sudden, in Breakfast at Tiffany's, chic was no longer this faraway thing only for the wealthy.
Yeah, that's great. I'm glad you reminded me of that. Yes, they made it democratic. You know, that's what the little black dress does. It's inexpensive, it's easy, it's functional. You don't have to be rich, and it isn't an elaborate costuming process. You just throw it over the couch when you're done with it, and you pick it up and jump into it when you're ready to go. It can go from work. It can go to a cocktail party. That's new, and that's perfect for Holly and the young woman, the modern woman, as I call her in my book.
We should talk for a moment about why you've titled the book Fifth Avenue 5 a.m. You are referring to a very important scene in the film, in some respects the most famous scene in the film, and the really tense circumstances with so much at stake under which this scene was filmed.
That's exactly right. This is the first scene of the movie when the taxi pulls up Fifth Avenue in front of Tiffany's, and Audrey, as Holly, gets out and stands in front of the store and has her breakfast at Tiffany's. It was, I'd say, quite dramatically, the first scene they shot in the movie. And a scene of tremendous anxiety for Audrey as her first day as Holly Golightly. She was cold in that little black dress. She was scared for reasons we discussed earlier, I believe. She had to do take after take, not to mention the fact that she didn't like danishes in the first place. And she asked Blake Edwards, the director, if she could eat ice cream. Well, Blake reminded her that no one eats ice cream for breakfast, and that was the end of that idea. But it's also the dawn, you know, I subtitle the book The Dawn of the Modern Woman, so it's not just, you know, 5 a.m. for Holly, but it really is the beginning of a new day for a new type of screen woman. So that was a nice little synchronicity that worked out in my favor.
Absolutely. And you remind us that, you know, this is the very first film ever to shoot inside Tiffany's itself. I mean, so a bit of history was being made just by them being allowed into the moment.
Right.
And then your film, of course, your book, of course, tells us a great deal more about the actual making of the film, details which we can leave to our listeners to explore. I wanted to just talk with you about some of the overview you share, which really helps us understand the difference between various directors. I mean, the kind of director that Blake Edwards was, and particularly in the way that he worked with Audrey Hepburn, versus the way that other directors like William Wyler or Billy Wilder had worked with her in previous films. I mean, there are all kinds of different ways to do it. And it does seem like in some very significant ways, Blake Edwards was exactly the right man for the job at this point in time.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I'm you're right on the money as usual. Without Blake, it's hard to imagine Audrey turning out this performance. It's very easily her funniest character, and Blake was one of her funniest directors, a master of comedy for sure. And Blake was renowned for making his actors feel comfortable. His sets were quite like parties themselves. Everybody was friendly, and that environment was essential when it came to making Audrey feel at ease in this very difficult role. You know, not every director can create such an easygoing working environment. There is so much that goes on, so much that goes wrong, so much anxiety and so much money on the line and so many egos clashing at one another, that to be able to simply create a calm work environment is a talent in and of itself. Blake did that. Audrey didn't always get to work that way. And I think you see that, you know, her best films are ones that were directed by men who could really give her that atmosphere that she needed to do her work. You know, remember, Audrey's not really an actress. So she has special considerations. There's certain concerns that one must keep in mind when making an Audrey Hepburn movie.
I love this observation which you make. This is as Blake Edwards is asking Audrey Hepburn if she is ready to kind of go ahead with this very tricky scene to be filmed in Tiffany's with so much time and money and on the line. So Blake asked Audrey if she was ready to go. She said she was. The trick, as Edwards was beginning to realize, was to catch her at just the right moment, after she warmed to it and before diminishing returns. Blake had to find that sweet spot and harness it. And someplace else, I think you might quote maybe a past interview, I assume, with Buddy Epson, who was also in this film, in which he kind of makes a similar observation about how the shifts in various takes can be incredibly subtle, and yet they can be the difference between sheer perfection and something else. And
yeah, especially when you're dealing with a non-actor like Audrey. You know, she can't get there every single moment like a trained pro. She needs a few takes of rehearsal to feel warmed up, and then you need to get her, because after a certain number of takes, she's going to get brittle, she's going to get tired, and she's not going to have the technique to get her back to that sweet spot, as I said. So it really is a matter of timing. And again, that's a credit to Blake, that he can create that environment where she could get to that sweet spot, and he could make sure that he can harness it and have his camera at the right place, because he only has a few chances.
Hmm. The final point I want to discuss with you involves the man to whom Audrey Hepburn was married at the time that this film was made, Mel Ferrer.
Right.
And it's an interesting marriage which seems to become more troubled over time. But one of the things you spend a significant amount of time talking about is, in a sense, the interference which Mel Ferrer was contributing on the side until a moment came when Blake Edwards had to really sort of put his foot down. Just talk a moment about Mel Ferrer's perhaps well-meaning but ultimately unhelpful contributions, and what changed when that was sort of cut out of the equation.
Well, you know, Mel Ferrer was obviously deeply involved, probably too involved in the affairs of his wife, and he himself was a director and had his own ideas about how this character ought to be played. And at night, when Audrey would go home, Mel would work with her on the next day's material. Now, Blake Edwards got a sense of this early on, and saw that Audrey would go home thinking one thing and come back to the set the next day thinking another. And he had to say to Audrey, you know, it's either him or me. I'm glad Blake won. You know, we can't know what went on in that room. Audrey was not around for me to interview, and neither was Mel Ferrer, unfortunately. But knowing the kind of man Mel Ferrer was and the kind of man Blake Edwards was, it would be a good guess to say that Mel wanted her to go darker, and Blake wanted to keep it light.
Hmm. And it made all the difference, evidently, that Blake Edwards asserted himself. It needed to be either he needed to be the director, or there couldn't be any director at all. She had to trust him.
Yes.
Evidently did. And what a difference that seems to have made.
Yes, yes. I'm so glad you brought this up. Well, I don't often get to discuss the subtleties of these points, but, you know, it beyond The Little Black Dress and Moon River and Audrey Hepburn, all these things, there is so much that ought to be said about Blake Edwards in this film, even though we don't think of it as a Blake Edwards movie. It could not have been made without him. So thank you for mentioning that.
Sam Wasson's book is titled Fifth Avenue, 5 a.m., Audrey Hepburn, Breakfast at Tiffany's, and the Dawn of the Modern Woman. Monday's morning show will include a conversation with writer Mark Elliott, who has penned lengthy and thorough biographies of a number of important Hollywood legends. His latest book, a biography of Charlton Heston. You'll hear from him on Monday's morning show. Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing